Okay. Welcome. My name is Divine. I'm a PGY1 transitional year resident that's going into our radiology. In this podcast, we are going to be doing another USMLE Step 1 Rapid Review, and this will also be again neuro. This will be relatively short because unfortunately I'm not feeling super well today. Okay, so let's just jump right into it, right? So what if you get a question about a person that, you know, they have like some kind of arterial rupture that's causing like a rapidly progressive increase in intracranial pressures. I really hope you're thinking about like an epidural hematoma, right? I remember that it's associated with like a temporal bone fracture and a rupture of the middle meningeal artery. Remember, that's one of the terminal branches of the maxillary artery, which is a branch of the external carotid. So that's kind of like the big relationship you want to remember there. And don't forget your lens-shaped lesion on a non-contrast CT, right? For those people, you want to emergently refer them to neurosurgery. And then what if you get a simple question on a person that has, you know, like they've smoked for like 60 years and then they have like a droopy eyelid and they have like papillary meiosis and they don't sweat on one side of their face, right? I really hope you're thinking about a Horner syndrome, right? Remember, that's this thing they have is likely like a Pancoast tumor that's compressing their cervical sympathetic tracts, okay? And it's causing an ipsilateral Horner syndrome. Horner syndrome lesions are usually ipsilateral to the side where you see the deficits. And then what if you see, what's the cranial nerve that could be lesioned that could give you like ptosis and mydriasis? So remember, Horner syndrome is ptosis and meiosis, right? So papillary constriction. What's the cranial nerve lesion that will give you ptosis and mydriasis? I really hope you're thinking about an oculomotor nerve lesion, right? So a cranial 3 lesion. The ptosis, right? You'll get that because remember, your levator palpebrae superioris no longer works because that's innervated by cranial nerve 3. And then the mydriasis you'll get because your sympathetic nervous system is acting on a post. Remember that cranial nerve 3 carries parasympathetic nerve fibers that relates to the eye, right? And those parasympathetic fibers cause papillary constriction or meiosis. So if you knock out cranial 3, you have papillary dilation or mydriasis, right? So that's the whole thing about the blown pupil. That's like the pathophysiology behind that. And then what if a person has like a lesion to the subthalamic nucleus? What would they have? Right? I really hope you're thinking about like a hemibolismus, right? So they'll have like flailing movements of the of one arm, and the arm will be contralateral to the side with the subthalamic nucleus lesion. Now, what if a person has a lesion of the frontal eye field, right? So a lesion of the frontal eye field, where will their eyes deviate? This is actually kind of high yield to know for step one and step two. And your neural shelf as a third year, right? So if a person has like a frontal eye field lesion, right, their eyes will actually deviate towards the side of the lesion. So you may say, Divine, how does that make sense? The thing is, the frontal eye field, right, say for, let's just choose one side of the brain. Let's say the right frontal eye field. It actually goes down from the cerebral cortex and projects to the left PPRF, right? So the left paramedian pontine reticular formation. So the left PPRF is connected to the left cranial 6, the left abducens nucleus. And then somehow through some pathway known more as likely like the MLF, it is connected to the right cranial 3 nucleus, right? So basically, let's map it out this way. So right frontal eye field is connected to the left PPRF, the left paramedian pontine reticular formation. And then the left PPRF is connected to the left abducens nucleus and the right oculomotor nucleus, right? So basically, the whole point of this system is for horizontal conjugate gaze, right? You want to go from, let's say you want to look all the way to the right without having any issues, right? If your right PPRF, let's say you want to look all the way to the left, right? Like conjugate horizontal gaze to the left, your left PPRF will fire, right? That will help you activate your left cranial 6, your left abducens nerve. So you will abduct your left eye, but you will adduct your right eye, right? So if you think about it, if you have to adduct your right eye, that means your right cranial 3 has to be working, right? So really, instead of memorizing this, you can just sort of work it out in your brain. Kind of makes a lot of sense, right? So if you sort of think about it, if you lesion like your right frontal eye field, your left PPRF will not work. If your left PPRF does not work, that means your right PPRF will act unopposed. If your right PPRF is acting unopposed, right, that means you have connections to the right cranial six and intact connections to the right cranial six nucleus and intact connections to the left cranial three nucleus, right? So your right eye will AB duct and your left eye will AD duct, right? So basically, if you have a frontal eye field lesion, your eyes will deviate towards the side of the lesion. That's the pathophysiology behind that. If you sort of bring up an analogous question like, oh, what happens if you screw up your PPRF itself, right? So let's say you screw up your left PPRF, right? Again, if you screw up your left PPRF, that means your right PPRF will be acting unopposed. And with your right PPRF acting unopposed, right? Remember, your right PPRF is connected to the ipsilateral or the right cranial six nucleus and the contralateral or the left cranial three nucleus, right? So that means your eyes will deviate to the right, right? So that means whenever you have a PPRF lesion, because your right cranial six, right, is causing your lateral your right lateral rectus to AB duct, and your left cranial three is causing your left medial rectus to AD duct. So whenever you have a PPRF lesion, your eyes will deviate towards, your eyes will deviate away from the side of the lesion. So frontal eye field lesion, that's a cortical issue. Your eyes will deviate towards the side of the lesion. PPRF lesion, that's more of a brainstem issue. Your eyes will deviate away from the side of the lesion, okay? It's actually kind of high yield to know that. And the thing is, I expand more on like these concepts in the neuro podcast I actually have for third year. So if you're a med student that's actually studying for step one and you have like 8 or 9 free hours on your hands, I would actually kind of like recommend listening to the neuro podcasts that I have for like third years. It's actually super helpful. Like, it will make you like super well grounded in neuro. But again, I will also do neuro podcasts for that are specifically targeted towards a step one. The only thing is that those third year podcasts, they're just very clinical, because that's kind of the way your third year shelf exams are. Now, what if you get a question about a patient and they have trouble like with upward gaze, right? So they have like paralysis of upward gaze. What's the structure in the brainstem that's potentially lesioned? Well, I really hope you're thinking about the superior colliculus, right? Remember, the superior colliculus is in the dorsal midbrain, right? And if you have like Parinaud syndrome, right? So let's assume you have like you can have Parinaud syndrome, or let's say you have like a pineoloma, right? Because remember that the pineal gland is superior to the superior colliculus. So whenever you have like a pineal gland tumor, right, that can compress the superior colliculus, and you can have paralysis with upward gaze. Now, what if you get a question about a person, you know, they say that, oh, accommodation is just fine, but when you try to do the pupillary light reflex, it's not working out so well. And let's assume they're a sex worker. I really hope with that you're thinking about tertiary syphilis, right? And the Argyll or Robertson pupil. Now, let's assume you get a question about a guy, you know, gets into a super severe accident, and then for some reason he cannot form new memories, right? So what's the portion in the brain that's lesioned that helps you form new memories, right? That's the hippocampus, okay? That's, again, a high-yield thing you want to keep at the back of your mind. Now, what if you get a question about a patient, the let's say like their acquaintances say that this person has been acting super weird, making like sexually suggestive comments, and then let's say the person dies, God forbid, right? And then you're doing like a pathology analysis, right? And you look at their brain grossly and you see like this, basically, let me give you the boss phrase, knife edge atrophy of the cerebrum, right? So of the cerebral cortex. If you see that, what kind of dementia are you thinking about? I really hope you're thinking about frontotemporal dementia, right? Remember, classically on exams, shows up in like guys in their 40s, 50s, early 60s, and then over like a 1 to 3 year period, they begin to have just weird behaviors, like they have issues with like executive function, but usually like they just begin to like just do a lot of inappropriate things. If you see that, think about frontotemporal dementia. That's also known as Pick's disease. Now, what's the vascular lesion that's associated with, like, you know, they tell you that, okay, this person has a vascular lesion and they have like complete quadriplegia. So like all their lower extremities, all their upper extremities, just gone in terms of motor function. Think about some kind of like locked-in syndrome, right? Remember, I told you that this can arise from like a basilar artery stroke or like a basilar artery aneurysm, right? But a more metabolic cause of that, of a locked-in syndrome, would be like, will be if you correct a hyponatremia too quickly, right? Remember the mnemonic that if a person goes from low to high, the pons will die. Okay, now, what if a person, you know, has trouble, they give you a question about a patient, and they can't write, they cannot calculate, and they cannot tell which finger is which. Like, oh, they don't know, like, this is this finger, this is that finger. What kind of parietal lobe lesion are you thinking about? I really hope you're thinking about a dominant parietal lobe lesion, okay? In fact, there's a term for this disorder. It's actually known as Gerstmann syndrome, okay? Basically, it's a lesion to your dominant parietal lobe, so you have trouble, like, doing math, trouble, like, writing, and then sort of, like, telling, like, oh, this is this finger, this is that finger. That's kind of how you ought to know. So you want to be able to contrast a dominant parietal lobe lesion with a non-dominant parietal lobe lesion, right? Because basically, if you lesion your non-dominant parietal lobe, you basically have issues like recognizing one side of your body, okay? So these are people that will like comb one side of their hair, or they will apply makeup to one side of their face. That's more of a non-dominant parietal lobe lesion. Now, and the thing is, just a high yield thing to know is, you may see, Divine, how do I know what parietal lobe is dominant for me? Well, the thing is, most human beings are right-handed, right? If you're right-handed, that means your left parietal lobe is your dominant parietal lobe. If you're left-handed, you're kind of like swimming in like weird waters. Those people may have like co-dominant parietal lobes or whatever. It's just kind of weird situation. But I'll say for most people, your dominant parietal lobe is your left parietal lobe. Again, being left-handed does not confer any disadvantages to you. I actually think it's kind of cool for people that write with their left hands. It's actually kind of difficult to do. But that's a different story that we can have on another, different conversation we can have on another day. Okay, now, what if a person has a brainstem lesion and they just completely lose consciousness? What is the brainstem structure that has been lesioned? So what's the system that activates you, right? That's your reticular activating system, okay? Now, what if you get a question about, you know, like a super tall athlete has the worst headache of his life, right? Super tall, that's the key thing there. Super tall athlete, worst headache of his life. I really hope you're thinking about Marfan syndrome, right? Remember, in Marfans, those people tend to get a lot of like anterior communicating artery aneurysms, right? And those aneurysms, if they rupture, that can cause like a subarachnoid hemorrhage, and that can present as the worst headache of the patient's life. Okay, now what if you get a question about a patient with elevated creatinine, right? So their creatinine clearance is not great, and they also again present with the worst headache of their lives. I really hope you're thinking about like ADPKD, right? So like autosomal dominant polycystic kidney disease. Remember that those people, again, right? Remember classically, it's associated with having like cysts in the kidneys, having cysts in the liver. That's actually kind of high yield to know. It's also associated with mitral valve prolapse, right? And it's also associated with aneurysms in the circle of Willis. That's very high yield to know for exams. Now, what if you get a question about a patient with connective tissue disease that has the worst headache of his life, right? I really hope you're thinking about EDS, right? So like Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. Probably the one we're most concerned about is like the type 3 Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. That's like the vascular Ehlers-Danlos syndrome that arises with like a defect in type 4 collagen, if I'm not mistaken. So remember, those people tend to have like hyperextensible skin and all that crap. Okay, so remember that Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, Marfan syndrome, and I don't know, I feel like this Ehlers-Danlos syndrome involves type 3 collagen. Yeah, I don't know, I'm thinking that Ehlers-Danlos syndrome involves a type 3 collagen defect. Yeah, you know what, I'm 99.9% sure it's a type 3 collagen defect, not type 4 collagen. Yeah, I'm going to go with a type 3 collagen defect. That's the correct thing. Okay, sorry again. These are, again, sort of kind of like off-the-cuff lectures. So, yeah, but I'm pretty sure it's type 3. So type 3 collagen defect. Okay, what if you get a question about, or you know what, let's just put it this way. What if a person has an arterial lesion, right, and they kind of have like a basal ganglia hemorrhage, right? Just think of this boss phrase as like a French term, so it's high yield for test, right? So a Charcot-Bouchard microaneurysm, right? Now, what if you get a question about a patient, right, that has a brain bleed and the lesion on CT imaging does not cross suture lines? What are you thinking about? I would really hope you're thinking about an epidural hematoma under those circumstances. What's the analogous lesion, I guess, that actually does cross suture lines, right? That'll be more of like a subdural hematoma, right? Now, what's the blood vessel lesion, right? That'll be associated with a person, like an old person that falls. So an old person that falls. I would want you to think more about a subdural hematoma with that. Remember, that happens when you have like a rupture of your bridging veins. Classically, if a person is an alcoholic, or if a person is an old person that falls, or a person, or you have like a non-accidental trauma in a kid, think more about subdural hematomas with those three classic exam scenarios. Now, what's the, I guess, what would the physical exam finding be in a victim of a severe accident who has severe uncal herniation, right? That would be like a down and out eye, right? That's the classic way. And it'll usually be like, you'll see like the blown pupil. They usually put pictures on exams to highlight those things. Now, what's the bug, I guess, that'll be associated with paralysis in an immigrant? Paralysis in an immigrant, right? So you really want to think about like a polio virus, right? Remember that polio loves to affect the anterior horn, also called the ventral horn of your spinal cord. Now, what if you see like, like a sensory ataxia in a person that has like a past medical history of a painless chancre, right? I really hope with that you're thinking about like tibis dorsalis and syphilis. Remember, syphilis can basically screw up the dorsal horn of your spinal cord, okay? So your dorsal column, medial and meniscus pathway at the level of the cord can be all screwed up by syphilis. Okay, now, what is the drug of choice in the treatment of like a 25-year-old female that has like headaches and photophobia? What's like the acute treatment for those patients, right? So really bad headache that's worsened by like loud noises, louts, by bright lights and whatnot. What do you think will be able to treat? What would you use to treat that lesion acutely, right? I really hope you're thinking about a triptan, right? Like sumatriptan, for example. You can also use like an ergotamine compound, but triptans are the most common answers on exams. Remember, triptans are contraindicated in people that are taking like SSRIs. Remember, you can trigger serotonin syndrome because triptans, right, they have serotonin receptor agonist activity. And remember, they're also contraindicated in people that have a history of like Raynaud's phenomenon. So you probably don't want to give it to a person with like Crest scleroderma, right? Or a person that has like a Prinz medal, also called a variant angina. Because remember that sumatriptan, right, is a vasospastic compound. So basically, if a person has any kind of vasospastic disease, right, you probably want to make sure you avoid sumatriptan or like an ergot compound in those kinds of patients. Now, what if you get a question about like a college student that has like nuchal rigidity and then he presents with like massive abdominal bleeding? I really hope you're thinking about like Neisseria meningitis, right? And like the Waterhouse-Friedrichsen syndrome. Remember, that can arise in the setting of Neisseria meningitis. Yeah, so remember, right? Waterhouse-Friedrichsen syndrome. You can basically like have like adrenal hemorrhage, and then the mortality is actually pretty high. It's like more than 50% or some crazy number like that. Now, what if you see a patient that has like a rapidly fatal dementia? Let's say they recently had like a corneal transplant or something weird like that. And they tell you that, on physical exam, you observe myoclonus. What are you thinking about? I really hope you're thinking about CJD, right? So like Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. Remember that if you do like a lumbar puncture on these patients and you check their CSF, you'll find elevated levels of the protein known as 1433. Believe it or not, that is floridly high yield to know for exams, right? And remember that those people, if you do like pathological analysis of their brains, you'll see like beta pleated sheets, right? Because of the weird protein folding. And I promise I'll round this podcast up soon. Yeah, I'm not really feeling well at all. So what would your diagnosis be if a person has like this triad, right? Where they have like scanning speech, like they're like My name is this, right? So like scanning speech, right? And they have like intention tremors and they have like nystagmus. That's like a triad, right? In multiple sclerosis, there's like, it's like Charcot's triad of multiple sclerosis, right? Remember, there are many Charcot's triads in medicine, right? Probably the two biggest ones to remember are like the Charcot's triad of MS, right? So like the scanning speech, the intention tremor and nystagmus. And then there's also like Charcot's triad of like ascending cholangitis, like the fever, right upper quadrant pain and jaundice. I guess if you sort of throw in the altered mental status and hypotension, then you jump into the land of Raynaud's pentad. Now, what if a person has, like, let's say you perform a lumbar puncture on a patient that's like paralyzed from, that's having like an ascending paralysis, like a symmetric ascending paralysis. And they tell you that you perform like a lumbar puncture, and in the CSF you see like very high levels of protein, but the cell count is like normal. That's aberrant, right? Because normally, if you have like a very high white blood cell count in your CSF, your protein will be really high, right? But if you see like, you're like, wait, man, this protein is super high, but the cell count is normal. I really hope you're thinking about Guillain-Barré syndrome, right? This phenomenon is basically what's known as albuminocytologic dissociation, right? So albumino is the protein, cytologic are the cells, right? So normally, your protein level and your cell level sort of going, they're like directly proportional in your CSF. But if your protein level is high, but your cell count is normal, that is not agreeable, right? That's why it's called an albuminocytologic dissociation. Okay, that's pathognomonic for Guillain-Barré syndrome. Now, what if a patient has like a combination of like, you know, like a sensory ataxia and hyperreflexia, right? So what kind of vitamin deficiency are you thinking about? I really hope you're thinking about a B12 deficiency, right? And like a subacute combined degeneration of the cord. Remember, if you have a B12 deficiency, you'll kill your dorsal columns, and then you will also kill your lateral corticospinal tracts, right? So you have the hyperreflexia because you have an upper motor neuron issue, right, at the level of the cord. And then you have a sensory ataxia because remember, your dorsal columns, right, help you sense like fine touch, vibration, and proprioception, right? So you will not know where your joints are in space. If those people are sort of close their eyes, they can actually have like a positive Romberg test. I will explain the mechanism behind the Romberg test in a future podcast. Okay, now what is the enzyme lesion that's associated with like, you know, like progressive paralysis with no sensory deficits? So this person is having progressive paralysis and no sensory deficits. So first things first, what's the diagnosis, right? I really hope you're thinking about ALS, right? So like Lou Gehrig's disease, right? Amyotrophic and lateral sclerosis. Remember, it's associated with mutations in a superoxide dismutase. Now, what if you get a question about like a patient, right? Let's say this patient is now is like a 40-year-old patient having like behavioral changes. And let's say like this patient's dad died at like 45 and then the granddad died at like 50, right? Can you see that like where things are happening with like earlier ages in this generation? I really hope with that you're thinking about Huntington's disease, right? Remember that Huntington's disease, it's autosomal dominant inheritance, and it demonstrates the genetic principle of anticipation, like many other autosomal dominant disorders. Okay, now what's the drug of choice in the treatment? And remember, that's like a chromosome 4 defect. It's a trinucleotide repeat prop issue, like CAG repeats, right? So that's kind of easy to remember for exams. Now, how do we treat ALS? What's the drug of choice? Remember, right, ALS is Lou Gehrig's disease, and you treat Lou Gehrig's disease with riluzole, right? Remember, that's like an NMD receptor antagonist. And then, how do we treat Alzheimer's, right? So what are the drugs we use to treat Alzheimer's, right? Remember, Alzheimer's, the pathophysiology kind of involves degeneration of the basal nucleus of Meynert. And the basal nucleus of Meynert, it so happens, produces acetylcholine. So if your basal nucleus of Meynert is not working, right, then you won't produce acetylcholine. So you need as much acetylcholine as possible, right? And one way you can boost your levels of acetylcholine is by inhibiting the enzyme acetylcholinesterase that breaks down acetylcholine, right? So there are certain drugs like donepezil, galantamine, and rivastigmine, okay? Remember your D or G and your R. These are, again, super high yield to know for exams. Donepezil, galantamine, and rivastigmine, the acetylcholinesterase inhibitors that I use to treat Alzheimer's. Now, what would you find grossly in a patient that has, like, a 76-year-old guy that has, like, cogwheel rigidity? I hope you're telling me that you'll observe depigmentation of the substantia nigra, right? So this is Parkinson's disease. Okay, now what will be the gross anatomical finding in, like, a 40-year-old guy that has hyperkinesia? I hope you're thinking about, like, atrophy of the caudate, right? Like atrophy of the basal ganglia, right? So again, this is Huntington's disease. Okay, now what if you get a question about, like, an old guy, you know, he's kind of like forgetful and he has like visual hallucinations, right? So he's seeing things that are not there and he has like multiple syncopal episodes. What are you thinking about? That's Lewy body dementia. Okay, very high yield to know that for exams. Now, what if you get a question about like a 27-year-old, like like medical student that sort of complains of like pain that sort of feels like a band around his head? What kind of headache is this? That's a tension headache, right? And then let's assume you get a question about like a patient that has like a headache at 9 a.m. every day for weeks on end, and they have like a partial Horner syndrome. So let's say they have only like the ptosis and meiosis. What kind of headache is that? That's a cluster headache, right? And I mean, like, this cluster headache, what's like the quickest abortive therapy for a cluster headache? That's 100% oxygen, right? Again, all these things, I promise you, all these things are very high yield to know for exams. That's why I like these rapid review series. You can sort of go through a lot of material in a very short period of time. And what's, I guess, the drug of choice? So let's assume you have to prescribe a medication on an exam for a patient that has like transient, like electric shock like facial pain. What's your diagnosis for starters? I hope you're thinking about like trigeminal neuralgia, right? Like tic douloureux. So you treat that with carbamazepine. Remember, carbamazepine is a sodium channel blocker. It's one of those anti-epileptic medications. Now, what if you get a question about like an Asian male that has like a rock hard super red eye and he's just coming from a cinema? He went to watch like a movie. That will be closed angle glaucoma. Very good. That'll be closed angle glaucoma. That's a medical emergency, right? That patient would need like a laser iridotomy. You can also give them like pilocarpine, because pilocarpine, right, is a muscarinic receptor agonist. So it will, by causing pupillary constriction, it would dilate the canals of Schlemm. Okay, now, what if you get a question, you know, about a patient that, you know, they have a headache and they were recently rescued from a house fire, right? If you see that, what are you thinking about? I really hope you're thinking about carbon monoxide poisoning, right? Another classic way this shows up on exams, they'll talk about a patient that was like found unconscious at home in the winter. Basically, if the MBME tells you about something going on in the winter, you really, really want to ask yourself, why will this question not be testing carbon monoxide poisoning? So if you see winter, you really want to think about carbon monoxide poisoning on your MBME exams. That's like the first thing that should come to the surface of your mind before you even think about any other thing on your differential. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that has like, like a 60-year-old guy, for the last 6 weeks, he's been waking up with like severe headaches in the morning, sort of gets better as the day goes by. And then they tell you that, oh, they perform an MRI of the brain and they see like a weird tumor, a tumor crossing the corpus callosum, and it has like central necrosis, right? This is bad news, right? This is glioblastoma. This is a glioblastoma multiforme. This is just awful, awful, awful. I have not seen anyone I have only seen one person with GBM that has survived more than a year. GBM is a terrible disease. You would not wish that on anyone. Okay, and also lending my support to any families that, if you have any friends or relatives that have GBM, it's a tough thing to go through. I would not wish that on anyone, and I hope you get like some comfort, and I hope the person gets better. Okay, so back to this, right? So what if you get a question about a patient that has like, you know, they've been having like chronic headaches for a few months, and then let's say you perform like a brain biopsy of a lesion that you found, and you find like Samoma buddies. What are you thinking about, right? That's that'll be what? A meningioma, right? And another boss phrase you want to recognize on exams with that is like a parasagittal tumor. Remember that meningiomas love to grow like around the dura. They usually have like a dural tail. That's like the classic boss phrase. That's why you can find them like parasagittally. Remember, the if you sort of like cut sagittally through the brain, you'll see like the fox cerebri. That's a dural fold that basically separates the two cerebral hemispheres. Now, what if you get a question about a patient that has a brain tumor and they tell you that, oh, on histology, you find cells with a fried egg appearance, right? What would that be? That'll be what? An oligodendroglioma, okay? An oligodendroglioma. Okay, now what if they give you a question about a patient that has a history of like neurofibromatosis and then they tell you that, oh, they have a lesion at the cerebellopontine angle, and then they're trying to ask you for the embryologic origin of that lesion. I really hope you're thinking about neurocrest. I remember these people can have like acoustic neuromas, right? So those are schwannomas. Remember that your Schwann cells are derived from neurocrest, and these tumors classically stain positive for S100. Okay. Now, what's the what if they give you a question about like a kid that's having like visual problems, having like signs of like hypopituitarism, and then they tell you that on imaging you find like a calcified suprasellar mass. What are you thinking about, right? So this will be a craniopharyngioma, right? Some people call this an adamantinomatous craniopharyngioma. Remember that it's actually very high yield to remember that this is derived from a rat keys pouch, okay? And it's the thing that classically drains a modal oil fluid on pathology. That's actually like cholesterol crystals and all that crap. It's not like real like modal oil. Okay, now I guess to sort of round up today, what if you get a question about a patient that has like a GI malignancy, like a stomach cancer, and then they have a headache, and then they show you like, they say like, oh, this is a histological section from like a brain biopsy or something, and you find like Homer right rosettes. What are you thinking about? I hope you're thinking about a medulloblastoma, right? Remember, this syndrome, right? Torkel syndrome. It's associated with like GI malignancies, like visceral tumors and also brain tumors. Classically on exams are medulloblastomas, okay? So I'll just sort of keep those at the back of your mind. If you have any questions, please feel free to reach out to me. And as I always say, if I end any podcast, I offer one-on-one tutoring for the USMLE Step 1, 2CK, 2CS, and 3 exams, preclinical med exams like your first 2 years of med school, shelf exams, medicine in training exams, the medicine board exams, organic chemistry, physics. I tutor all these things pretty much. Also general chemistry. And then I also do application advising, right? So if you're a med student applying for residency, like ERAS apps, or college students applying for med school, so like AMCAS apps, I do offer like application advising. I've been on the admissions committee of like a top 2 medical school in this country for like a year, right? So I have certainly helped a ton of people with that, and pretty much everyone I advise has matched. So feel free to reach out to me anytime, send me a message, and we'll go along. And then one thing I recently put up on the website is like a 12-day USMLE course, where it's like an in-person like class, like 5 to 7 people, and we basically review everything in an integrated format that's tested on the USMLE Step 1 exam or the 2CK exam or the Step 3 exam. So if that's something you're interested in, if you have like a small group of like 5 to 7 people that will need any of that kind of, that are interested in that kind of class, just send me an email. It will basically take place over like 12 days. It will be an in-person review. We can also do like an online thing, but that's if every member of the class is agreeable to it. But again, just sort of reach out to me. It's something I can arrange, and then we can go from there. So I wish you the best. Have a wonderful rest of the day, and God bless you. I'll see you in the next podcast.